I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, it's Midday on Ethics. The heartbreaking case of little Charlie Gard raises questions that the parents of very sick children face every day. What happens when parents want to try anything to save their child, even when doctors say there's no hope? Who makes treatment decisions then? In the UK, the courts decide. And in the US, who decides what's in the best interest of a child who's dying? And who gets to say when treatment is no longer appropriate? We'll explore these questions with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Sick children and parental rights. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Before we begin today, I'd like to send a shout out to my friend Mark Steiner, who just a few minutes ago signed off for the last time from his daily talk show on WEAA, the public radio station based at Morgan State University. Mark has been a presence on Baltimore's airwaves for more than 24 years, and he always made sure to have a diverse group of voices on his shows. That's a value that we share and try to emulate here on Midday, and we wish Mark all the best as he enters a new chapter doing various projects with his Center for Emerging Media. So today on our program, it's another edition of Midday on Ethics. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. When he stops by Midday, we talk about all manner of complex dilemmas. Today, we're going to have a conversation about the ethical questions surrounding the case of Charlie Gard. He's the infant in Britain who died on Friday, a week shy of his first birthday. He was critically ill for all of his short life. He had a rare genetic condition that left him brain damaged and unable to move or breathe on his own. His parents sought permission from UK courts to do what they thought was best for their son. First, they wanted to take him to the United States for an experimental treatment. And more recently, his caregivers said that there was nothing more that they could do to help him, and that he would die without artificial life support. His parents wanted to take him home from the hospital to die, and in both instances, the courts ruled that what the parents wanted was not in the best interest of little Charlie. So this sad case reminds us that there are ethical questions that parents of very sick children and their doctors face all the time. What does it mean to act in the best interest of a critically ill child, and who gets to decide that? And when does parents' rights to make life and death decisions for their infant, when do those rights begin and when do they end? You can join our conversation here on Midday on Ethics, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle if you'd like to join us there, and that'd be terrific if you would do that, at Midday Tom Hall. Jeff Kahn, good to see you.
Great to be here.
So you've actually just gotten back. You've been in England for a couple of weeks. Is this like all the buzz? Is this the kind of thing that people are talking about all the time?
It turned out not to be where I was, interestingly enough. I think they were more engaged by the media coverage on this side of the Atlantic than they were in the particularities of that case in London. So interesting perspective, having been over on the other side at a turns out to be an appropriate time.
Yeah. So there are just a number of issues that arise. First of all, tell us a little bit about this young infant, Charlie Gard, and the condition with which he was diagnosed and why it's why it was so difficult to treat.
So I think your intro was really perfect in setting it up. He had a rare genetic disorder, as you pointed out, that had to do with the way his mitochondria function. So those are the power plants effectively within the cells in our body. His didn't work normally, and that led to all sorts of problems for him from the moment he was born. He had severe muscle atrophy, brain atrophy. He couldn't interact with the world. And so it was a critical condition from the moment he was born, not quite incompatible with life, but quite close. And so the parents were faced with a very challenging decision from the moment that he was born.
So this case, you know, brings up so many things that the parents, the medical folks, and then ultimately the courts had to decide. Number one is who gets to decide. Is it the parents? Is it the courts? Is it the doctors? And who pays for it? Had he come to the United States for experimental treatment, they had raised, the family had raised $1.3 million, that's even more dollars, to be able to pay for that coverage, or at least begin to pay for it. And then, you know, when we use the term the best interest of the child, what does that mean? What's the best interest for any of us? I mean, so you wrestle with these things. How should we frame these kinds of questions?
Yeah, I think hit it right on the head again. Part of the way we answer that question in the United States has been we want to know what people would prefer. So you and I can express our wishes. And often we're asked in advance of going into the hospital to prepare a document called an advance directive, either setting out what we would or wouldn't accept in terms of treatment as we're getting to the end of our life, or better, appointing somebody to make those decisions on our behalf. The idea being that you would articulate your wishes to that person so they could offer them when you were not able to. In a case of a child who's born critically ill, that isn't possible. So that's the challenge in a case like this. We don't know what Charlie would have wanted when he found himself in this situation. He was obviously a baby. He was born this way. We never could have known that. And so,
and by the way, let me interrupt just briefly to say, if there is a living will, as it were, or a document
an advance directive,
this is what I want.
Yes.
Does that trump everything else? I mean, do the courts just always say, okay, that person has stated his or her wishes, and there's no question about it?
No. Sometimes there can be disagreements. Often it's within the family that's able to speak on behalf of the person who can't speak for themselves. So if there's agreement with the family or the person who's appointed and the document, then there's no concern, right? There's no disagreement. But when the aunt and the uncle don't agree, or the parents and the siblings don't agree about what should happen to the patient, that's when courts get involved, unfortunately. And so it gets worked out. I think when push comes to shove, we hope that the advance directive would have the force of decision making.
Yeah, I mean, the absence of an advance directive is never a good idea.
No.
Right? And, I mean, any adult should make sure that he or she has one. But of course, an infant wouldn't even be, even if this infant's perfectly healthy, he wasn't going to be able to make an advance directive.
So we fall back to a concept called substituted judgment. Someone else has to make a judgment on behalf of that other person and make a decision as they deem to be in the best interest of that child in this case. So as you said in the introduction, what would be in the best interest of a critically ill newborn? Would it be in his interest to be treated, presumably to sustain his life and maybe improve his life? Or is it in his interest not to be allowed to continue to suffer, which is what the courts in England said? His life is all suffering and no benefit. Now, someone has to make a judgment about whether that's the case, and it's obviously subjective. We don't have a way to measure that. But all sorts of criteria we can look at. He couldn't interact with the world. He couldn't eat on his own. He couldn't breathe on his own, as it was getting later in the course of his condition. And so at some point you say his interaction is all about suffering and not about enjoyment or benefiting from life. And that's what the courts determined in this very tragic case. And interestingly, if it were in the U.S., we would actually defer, I think, to a much greater extent to the parents. Now, of course, there has to be
more so than in the U.K.
Correct. We would defer to the parents to make that judgment on behalf of their child, up to the point where there's an agreement on the part of the medical care providers and usually the institution where the care is being provided that it's futile. That is, it can have no benefit. It's impossible for it to have benefit. And we don't provide futile care to individuals. So institutions are actually able to refuse and say this is not going to have any benefit. It's futile, and therefore we won't do it. And sometimes courts get involved in those cases. But when there's a potential for some benefit, and so it can be very slight, we defer to parents to allow them to make decisions on behalf of their children to, say, enroll them in a very experimental new therapy.
And in a heartbreaking statement to the courts, Charlie Gard's mom, Connie Yates, basically said when she and her husband decided that they were going to drop any remaining challenges to court decisions, because the UK courts, the European Union courts, all sided with the hospital who was advocating to basically take this little infant off of life support. She basically says that if treatment had started sooner, Charlie would have had a chance. I suppose there's no way of knowing whether that's true or not. You can imagine how she would want to believe that and would hold on to that. But of course, they weren't doing any of the treatment because they were arguing about this in court.
Yeah, and because there was a sense from the very early stages of the case that it would have been futile. So there's a sort of contention here about whether even understanding the desire on the part of parents to do what is best for their child, what they deem to be best for their child, there was a contention very early on that nothing would have helped him. And there's a sort of tragic element on top of the tragedy here, that they seem to have been offered potentially false hope by a physician at Columbia here in the United States that there was some therapy that may have been helpful, but that was suggested in advance of him seeing the records of or examining Charlie himself. And so there's
that doctor is making a judgment without examining the patient or even looking at the records.
Or that's at least what the parents heard. So this is a lot of information that I imagine will come out in the course of weeks and months going forward. But there seems to be a sense that these were desperate patients who were offered false hope. And they heard in the willingness of this physician to examine Charlie and maybe make a judgment or offer them some information about whether what he had might be helpful to Charlie, they might have heard there's a chance for him to receive some benefit from this experimental therapy, and we want to pursue it. So I don't want to cast aspersions here, but there seems to have been a sense that these were extremely desperate, as any parents would be, right? Parents to help their child who were given a sliver of hope by this potential experimental therapy in the U.S., and they seized on that maybe to a greater extent than was realistic.
And, of course, it got lots of play in the media, not only in the U.K., but throughout the world. President Trump sent a tweet out about it saying, sure, bring them to the United States, and Pope Francis got involved saying that anything could be done, should be done to extend this little baby's life. The other part of this, I mean, when it comes to the futileness of the potential treatment, that's one thing. But then they also wanted him to go home to die. Once they decided he was in hospice and they wanted him to go home, the courts even disallowed that.
Yeah, and I'm not 100% sure why that was the case. I think he needed very significant care to be maintained.
He was on a ventilator.
Yeah, so it's difficult to do that at home. And I don't know whether there was some sense that they would try to do something different, untoward, if they had been permitted to take him home. We should have said this at the beginning. I mean, you said the tragic case, and maybe we should say a little bit more about how tragic. I mean, it's a horrible situation for any parents. This poor little boy was born into an impossibly difficult life. There's not a lot of positive to be said about this. It is unfortunate that it's not a unique case. There are critically ill newborns born every day, and very hard decisions are made every day about whether to continue treatment or not, and always focusing on what is best for them. And so this is a disagreement where the parents had a different view about what was best for Charlie, their son, than did the physicians and other medical staff caring for him and the hospital where he was being cared for, who thought his best interest would be served by allowing him to die.
Let's grab a call before we take a break. Les in Laurel, welcome to Midday on Ethics with Dr. Khan from the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. Thanks for your call.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment about the last portion of the discussion, and that was that I totally agree that I don't know much about the beginning and, how much pain he was in for the court to decide that, there was nothing more that they could do, but knowing that this child was inevitably going to die, I think that it was extremely unfair for the child and for the parents to not be able to take him home, because they have been, you know, living with this stress and this pressure. And, you know, when you hear that information that this is the end, there's nothing more that we can do, I think that at such a young age and as a baby, you know, he should have been able to fall asleep in his mother's arms and pass that way, or be taken and be surrounded by family and love instead of in a hospital, because what's the point of, you know, keeping him on all of these things that are, you know, working or not working? And I just think that it's horrible that this mother and this father were ripped of so many opportunities to spend time with their son before he passed.
Well, thank you, Les, for your call. And I'm sure, you know, Les's view is one shared by many people. But Jeff Kahn, it's not as simple as, just do what they want to do in this situation. Because, again, we don't know all of the circumstances about this young patient's level of pain and level of discomfort at the end of his life when those machines were turned off. I mean, there were perhaps ways that they could manage his pain, manage his passing in a medical institution, in a hospital, that they couldn't handle at the house.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think there also was the level of contentiousness that this case had engendered, both in Charlie's life and also in his death. And I presume that there was some concern about what might happen if they took him home with all of the activism that had started around his case, whether they might try to take him somewhere else or who knows what. So I think it probably was a combination of factors that led to the decision to keep him in the Great Ormond Hospital and allow him to die comfortably there. I mean, I think there's a question about suffering. What counts as suffering for somebody who is in that state is a pretty interesting question to try to understand. One might argue he wasn't suffering because he was not able to interact with the world. His brain function was such that he probably didn't feel a lot of anything. And so does that mean he was suffering by being maintained or not? And I think that's among the kinds of questions that parents and care providers wrestle with in critically ill newborns of this kind.
And as you do all the time, you know, we try to define what suffering means, what best interest means, even what the notion of death means. And there are any number of different interpretations of what it means to be dead. There's a young girl in Oakland, California, we may talk about when we come back from a break, who was had a death certificate signed. And now the parents are saying this child is not dead. I mean, so even defining what death means is trickier than you might think. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about the ethical questions raised by the case of little Charlie Gard, the British infant whose parents went to court repeatedly seeking permission to seek alternative care for him, and most recently permission to let him die at home. So when and why do parents need a judge's permission to choose medical treatment or to end their child's life? Join us at 410-662-8780 with your take on this very, very poignant and sad case. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We're glad you're listening. Stick around.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up on the broadcast tomorrow, it's the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. We'll be joined by Rutgers professor and author Dr. Brittany C. Cooper. She's got a new book. It's called Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. So we're going to talk about the history and influence of Black women intellectuals tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about parents' rights in making life and death medical decisions for their children and the ethical questions raised by these cases, particularly the case of Charlie Gard, the little boy who died just shy of his first birthday on Friday. 410-662-8780. That's our phone number here on Midday to join the conversation. You want to join us on Twitter, at Midday Tom Hall. If you want to send us an email, midday@wypr.org. Let's go to the phones. Mary in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Khan.
Hi. I am listening to this conversation, and I feel like we haven't touched on the fact that Britain has socialized medicine, and that at the crux of this is perhaps a caveat for our, you know, wanting single-payer and government-run health care, that it does, in fact, take rights that parents have here in America. Most parents would be appalled to be told they couldn't bring their dying child home. And yet, in Britain, you know, despite that maybe it was a futile effort to save this poor child, but in the broader question, it's quite takes you aback that the government has that control to tell you you cannot leave the country to seek whatever medical care you want for your family, and that they will not even let you bring your child home. I mean, that's the real shocker in this to me, is that, mm-hmm. that people accept that. That the government has that right over them in England.
Okay, well, thank you, Mary, for that call. And so, Jeff Khan, let's examine the premise of Mary's question here. Does the fact that the courts intervened in these two instances, number one, to disallow what they determined to be futile treatment, and number two, to have the child released from the hospital to die at home, does that have anything to do with the fact that there is a single-payer system in Britain that is different than our system? I mean, Vice President Pence made headlines about Charlie Gard when he talked to Rush Limbaugh last week, saying that the American people ought to reflect on the fact that for all the talk on the left about single payer, that's where it takes us. Of course, single payer in some quarters on the political right is synonymous with Obamacare or the ACA. And of course, there's lots of evidence to the contrary there. But does this have anything to do with the fact that there is a system of socialized medicine in Britain?
I think the short answer is that's a red herring in this case, and that there are certainly differences in a system like the National Health Service in the UK, which is what their provision of health services is called. But even in this country, to the extent you think that we are free to seek treatments so long as we can pay for them, it does not mean that parents or individuals can seek non-beneficial treatments. So it doesn't matter if you show up with $2 million and say, we want to give this child this highly experimental treatment. If someone deems it to be non-beneficial, hospitals won't admit that patient and won't provide that care. So I don't think this is about socialized medicine in the UK and something different here. And so there obviously are differences, and we should debate the pros and cons of a single-payer system. I prefer that term than socialized medicine or government-provided health care. But I don't think this is a story that actually points to any particular fissure or difference between the way healthcare would be delivered in this country were we to have something closer to the National Health Service. I think in a case like Charlie Gard's, were he to be born in the United States, there probably would be a very similar kind of debate about whether he should be receiving a highly experimental, very expensive, what professionals believe non-beneficial therapy. And I think there would be a similar outcry from the same kinds of people as we're seeing in the UK version.
When it comes to this single-payer notion of a government-administered health system, there's an op-ed about Charlie Gard in the Washington Examiner, which was actually widely distributed in English papers as well, in which they contend that the socialization of medicine leads to a decline in experimentation and progress. They link the lack of, for example, this experimental treatment, which wasn't available in the UK, possibly available here in the United States, and they say that that's because there's this single-payer system in the UK. Do you buy that contention?
No, I think that's also a bit of a red herring. So it is true that the United States has long been, and I hope will continue to be, the the world leader in biomedical research. But that's because we're willing to invest many billions of dollars a year in things like the National Institutes of Health, which fund research on their campus in Bethesda and at many universities like mine at Johns Hopkins, which is the single largest recipient of NIH funds in the world. And so it's really about investment in biomedical research, but that isn't about how we pay for and provide healthcare in this country. And so one might argue if there were more efficient provision of healthcare in terms of costs, we'd have more money to spend on investment in biomedical research. So I don't think they're linked. Actually, I think that's a misunderstanding of the way biomedical research is funded.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. I'm Tom Hall. I'm the director of nothing. I'm the host of Midday here. You are listening, and we are delighted that you are doing so. We're talking about a tough subject, little Charlie Gard and the ethical questions that are raised surrounding his treatment and death. He died last Friday, just shy of his first birthday. 410-662-8780. We got a lot of calls. We're going to try to get to many of them post-haste. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Bowling in Baltimore, let's go to you. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom. The reason I'm anxious to talk today is because I think this subject is an important subject, but I don't think that the concept of hospice and the role that hospice plays when children like this are born is talked about enough. And I believe that when you politicize something like this, you do a terrible disservice to the parents who are caught in the middle. They have a child that is mortally ill, and when they hear the kind of racket that they heard from the United States last week, even from our president, it makes their decision thousands of times more difficult. And I don't think that we're serving this poor child by imagining that it's sentient and it can tell us that it's in pain. It's up to the professionals in hospice to know whether a child is in pain or not.
And as I understand it, Bowling, you are, in fact, a hospice worker. Is that you
that's
work
correct,
in hospice
yes.
professionally? So you see this
not
on a
professionally.
Day-to-day.
I'm just a volunteer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But with childhood hospice, and unfortunately, it happens quite frequently that children are born, and there is no real hope that they will make it past their first birthday. And it's very sad and extremely difficult for the parents. And when you politicize these things, you make it 20 gillion times more complicated for the parents.
Well, thank you for your call, Bowling. I appreciate it. Jeff Kahn, there was an op-ed in the New York Times by a doctor named Alicia Waldman. She's the chief, or about to become the chief, of the Division of Pediatric Palliative Care at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. And she says that it was just inexcusable for the hospital not to allow this little child to come home for his final hours. She contends that parents are the best advocates for children, and the courts and the doctors should just stay out of it.
Yeah. And I appreciate Bowling's call and what you just read. Parents want to do what's best for their children. And I'm sure in this case it is true. I don't think anybody's actually arguing otherwise. These are just extremely challenging and grief filled situations and tragic in every way. So I don't think anybody would argue otherwise. And by bringing so much media attention to the case, it certainly did not help them make a clear-headed judgment. I think it is unfortunate that they were not permitted to take him home for his final days and hours. And I don't understand exactly why that happened. I don't think we know yet. And I assume that will come out in the course of things. I presume it's partly a function of the politicization of the story, and that there was such strong activism, anti-abortion activists raising money and protesting, that there must have been some concern about what might happen were he to go leave the hospital. It wasn't that he was not permitted to go home. I think it's probably more about his leaving the hospital.
Yeah. They were concerned about
that's
him,
my guess.
His care. Yeah, Julia in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Yes. My question is, was this child diagnosed with these problems before he was born? And if so, why was there even any hope? If you can't breathe, you can't move, you can't do anything, why was the child even kept alive for so long?
All right, well, thank you for that call, Julie. As I understand it, Dr. Kahn, he was about a month old. He was born in August of last year, and by, you know, beginning of October, he wasn't gaining weight. So they took him to this Great Ormond Street Hospital, where he continued to be treating. He was putting on a ventilator, put on a ventilator then. So he's been on a ventilator since he was a month old. And then they took a while to have this diagnosis. So as far as we know, they were not aware of the fact prenatally that he was afflicted with this condition.
No, I think that's right.
And would that have mattered?
Well, right. So we can talk about that. So this was the first child of these two parents. So they didn't have any reason to think that there might have been a genetic risk if it was an inherited disorder, say. And so my understanding is, as you just stated, they were not aware until after he was born and had come home that something was – he wasn't thriving. And so they brought him to the hospital, and then it was determined that he was suffering from this rare, unfortunate mutation. And so I think that's the answer to the question. Had they – known, had reason to know, and a prenatal test was performed, then they would have had another very difficult decision, and that was whether to continue the pregnancy or to have an abortion, to terminate the pregnancy out of the same kind of thinking. It would just be better not to be brought into the world with this very challenging set of problems than it would be to be born and maintain and have a very short but painful life.
Tony in Baltimore, I think you have a question in this regard. Welcome to Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Yes, it was very similar to the previous question, is why genetic testing was not done prior to the baby's birth. It's unfortunate, and we all agree with that. However, could his malady have been picked up by genetic testing, or was it that rare that it could not?
Yeah, thanks for that call, Tony. And, you know, I guess there are protocols that take into account, for example, the age of the mother. I know when our daughter was born, my wife was a little older than many young moms, and so they did a certain number of tests. Amniocentesis was the test they did back in those days. This is the dark ages, 28 years ago.
Still done.
Yeah, yeah. And it's because of her age. So there was a risk of some problems with the pregnancy. It turns out, thank God, that we didn't have any trouble. But is that part of the program? I mean, Miss Yates, the mother, is certainly not a very old woman.
Yeah. So generally speaking, there is not genetic testing performed during pregnancy unless there are risk factors that would indicate that was appropriate to do, partly because there's no reason to look for something that there's no reason to expect exist. But there's also risk associated with things like amniocentesis, where a needle is put through the wall of the uterus and fluid is extracted. So there's some risk of miscarriage that comes with doing amniocentesis. So you don't want to do things that are risky to the pregnancy if there isn't reason to do it. Increasingly, there are genetic technologies that are less invasive that can be done actually just from blood drawn from the pregnant woman. And so I think we're probably coming to a time when that would be offered more frequently than it had been in the past. But this was a very rare mutation, and unless there's something called whole genome sequencing performed and compared to, you know, it would be finding needles in haystacks kind of thing.
So chances are pretty slim that they would have found this condition prenatal.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know the particular mutation, but they would have to somehow find it. And it would take a lot of looking to find something that was that one-off.
It's Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeffrey Kahn. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. And by the way, we've got a link to the Berman Institute on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up, more with Dr. Kahn. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, that would be great, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take a break, on Mondays here on our program, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in the previous week as their names are made public. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 204 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence, including two men who died in June and whose deaths were just ruled a homicide. They were ruled homicides last week. They are Daniel Brewer, who was 59 years old, and Terrell Frank, who was 29. Police have now identified three victims who were unidentified last week when we read our names of victims. They are Maurice Finney, age 22, Jose Gonzalez Jimenez, age 31, and Ray Woodland Jr., age 45. Eight other people were also the victims of homicide last week. They are Malone Sanders. She was 21 years old. Vince Waters, age 24. Nicole Rahim, age 28. Rashad Parks, age 19. Kevin Joyner, age 46. Donnell Pierce, age 23. Dustin McNeil, age 26. And Montez Macklin. He was 33 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Before we resume our conversation with Dr. Jeff Kahn, I'd like to make you aware of a special benefit concert that's coming up Sunday night at the Windup Space in Station North here in Baltimore. Sarah Hughes is a highly respected Baltimore-based jazz musician, and last week she was carjacked and beaten on her way home from a gig in Baltimore. So musicians are getting together to raise money so she can replace her saxophone, which was stolen, along with her money and her car, and to help defray her medical costs. Lafayette Gilchrist, John Dierker, Luke Stewart, Greg Tompkins, and lots of other folks are going to perform. So we wish Sarah a full recovery, and we hope she is back on the bandstand as soon as possible. We've got a link to details about the benefit concert for Sarah on our website, wypr.org/midday. If you're just joining us today, it's another installment of Midday on Ethics. My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Kahn, the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, who joins us regularly to sift through timely issues in bio and medical ethics. We're talking today about ethical questions surrounding caring for critically ill young children, particularly if the treatment sought by parents is unlikely to save a child's life. You are welcome to join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, and to join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go back to the phones, Jeff Kahn, with Paul in Baltimore. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank Dr. Kahn for leading this discussion. The ethical discussion so far has been focused on biomedical and legal issues, basically an empirical perspective. But I raised a question that's also an ethical question about how Charlie was treated as a person, the issue of personhood for someone in Charlie's state. And personhood is an ethical, definitely an ethical issue, as well as philosophical and spiritual. So not knowing what your background is in that whole breadth of stuff, I'd like to hear your comments on the issue of personhood in someone in Charlie's condition.
Thanks for the call, Paul. That's an excellent question. It's not a cut and dry matter, is it?
No. And Paul, thanks for your comments and question. I should disclose, I think I've said this before on the show, that my doctoral training is in philosophy. I have a PhD in philosophy. So moral philosophy in particular. So it's an area of a lot of interest for me. It's what I've studied. It's what I think about. And it's a complicated question that we as humans have wrestled with for a very long time. We know when life begins, but we don't always know when personhood begins. And so there's a lot of debate, certainly not an agreement, about the answer to that question. But personhood tends to be more tied to brain function, right? And life can be without personhood or with personhood. So think about brain death or death by brain criteria, which is really an attempt to identify when personhood has ended, even if one's heart continues to beat and lungs continue to breathe. So the body may still be alive, but the person is gone. And so in a case like Charlie's, we might profitably ask, did he ever have personhood? Was his brain so affected by his disease that he didn't ever have personhood? His brain functions never were to the point that he could interact with the world that we would think of as death by brain criteria might have applied to him very early in his life. I think it didn't, because they did all sorts of brain scans to determine what his brain function must or might have been like. And only in the latter parts of his diagnosis did it seem that he was heading towards death by brain criteria. But that's the attempt to answer Paul's question. And certainly, if somebody is a person, we want to do what's best for them, right? That's when we start to talk about best interests, because we don't talk about best interests of corpses, of bodies. And death by brain criteria is actually a way of determining when someone has died. It's not a different kind of death. It's a different definition of death. But we still are saying that person has died. And that's what permits us in this society to do organ donation after death. If we waited for whole body death, then the organs would not be usable for transplant. I'm talking about lungs, liver, kidneys, and even hearts. So hearts are still beating, and we've pronounced somebody dead, and that's death by brain criteria.
We've got a bunch of calls. If you're on the line, stay there. I'm going to do my best to get to you. But I do, before we go to those calls, Jeff, want to ask you about this case in Oakland, California, a young girl named Jahi McMath. She's 13 years old, and as of last week, there's a judge who's going to decide fairly soon whether or not to revoke her death certificate, which was issued by a hospital in California. The parents are saying she's not dead, and this is a 13-year-old kid who went in for a tonsillectomy and had complications in this surgery, and she's been unresponsive. So they can't even decide whether this young kid is alive or dead.
Yeah, and that's another horribly tragic case. And she was pronounced dead by brain criteria. And so that's a decision that is made by neurologists, by physicians who focus on this, and by more than one. It's multiple neurologists independently who are not caring for the patient as theirs in the course of his or her care, who are making a determination about certain criteria having been met. I'm not the right person to articulate what those are, but they're clear. And it's irreversible function of higher levels of the brain. And when that set of criteria have been met, that threshold has been crossed, a death certificate is signed. That person has been deemed dead. The family didn't agree with that diagnosis. Now, that's an interesting situation. We generally don't have that happen, which is why it got reported. We don't give people the option of opting out of what we take to be the definitions of death, right? And so it's of the same magnitude as somebody saying, I want to take home a corpse, in terms of what counts as dead. When a death certificate is signed, that person is deemed dead by the state of California or the state of wherever.
So we have a couple questions about health insurance. This is an email from Peggy, who says, I can speak only from my own family's experience, but having lived under both the French and the British national health systems, I pray for the day when my own country would go to a single-payer system. Why do we support a healthcare system that is against our own best interests? I've seen everything from paralysis, heart attacks, to hurt fingers, treated with amazing care at no extra cost to the family. The mere fact of paying into Social Security in France and just going to the doctor in the hospital in the UK was enough to give one excellent health care. What are we waiting for, Peggy asks, when it comes to single payer? So the obviously the implications for health care policy in cases like this are quite clear. Carol has a question about that. She's calling from what's described as East Maryland. So, Carol, welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, I do have the question about health care, which is, if a child such as Charlie were born and had this condition in our country, the U.S., and his family had no health insurance, what would be the treatment options for such a child?
It's a very good question, and at some point his care might be covered by federal programs like CHIP, which is for children who don't have other insurance. And so he, at some point, probably would have become his care would have been paid for by the government, and we probably would be having exactly the same conversation. And if they were able to raise money, as Charlie Gard's parents were, to try to pursue experimental treatment, I'm putting quotes in the air, then I think exactly the same conversation would have ensued on this side of the Atlantic. The difference would be it probably would not have gone to a kind of legal ending as it did in the UK. It probably would have been adjudicated institutionally by whatever healthcare institution he was being cared for, and they probably would have been able to pursue, if they were able to find the funds, something highly experimental. The idea being that we might learn something, at least, if it wasn't beneficial to him. So we might err on the side of trying something in the hopes that there's information that would be gained, if not benefit to the individual patient.
Thanks for the call, Carol. Important questions to ask as we all consider what healthcare policy in our country should be. Amy in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Hi, thank you. I want to address the relative hypocrisy of just about everybody who's been saying, well, you know, the parents have the best, know what's best for their children. That's only true under sort of fairly narrow group of circumstances. For example, if the child was a Native American and the parents felt that the best way to treat them was through traditional means, they would have been snatched away and put under medical care. Or if the child was Jehovah's Witness and the parents didn't believe it should have a blood transfusion, they felt, medical profession felt, that was the only way it could be saved, immediately the parents would be deemed unable to make a viable choice on the part of their child. So I think it's really important to recognize that while we say, well, you know, parents care deeply about their children, all parents care deeply about their children, and it's only if you, as a parent, conform to a fairly narrow range of this is what's best for every child, no matter what the parents think, that that is even true.
Thanks for the call.
It's a really good point, Amy. And you're right. There's an intervention in the willingness to allow parents to make decisions on behalf of their children, after great deference, frankly, to parents being able to decide what's best for their children, except in cases like what you just pointed out. And so when children are not able to decide for themselves and the decisions on the part of parents seem idiosyncratic, and denying what is standard medical care to their child, whether it's Jehovah's Witness and refusing blood transfusion, or sometimes you get fundamentalist Christians who don't believe in chemotherapy for cancer. And then courts are asked to intervene, and then it is deemed in the best interest of those children to be treated for their health care. And so you're right, it's within some range, but I would say it's not quite as narrow as you've made it sound, Amy.
We're going to give the last word to an email from a doctor who chooses not to release his name. He says, I practice palliative medicine for adults. It's not uncommon for care teams to be asked to transfer a very ill patient home to die with hospice. Palliative care teams and hospices try very hard to accomplish this. However, this isn't always possible. Hospice professionals want to avoid the patient dying while being transported at all costs. This may have been the case with Charlie Gard. And again, Jeff Kahn, we just don't know all the details, but I'm sure we will at some point. Well, it's good to see you, sir. Talk about this very sad but important topic, and we'll see you the next time.
Sounds good.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins me regularly for Midday on Ethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We've got details at wypr.org/midday. That's coming up for us today. Coming up, or that's it for us today, rather. Coming up tomorrow, Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland and Rutgers professor Dr. Brittany C. Cooper joins me. We're going to talk about the history and influence of black women intellectuals. We want to thank the Diz for providing lunch today. They're located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for spending some time with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.